I wasn't watching the clock, so everybody got an extra 4 minutes. Do what you want to do. Okay. We're on to item number 7. This is also a decision. Wildlife interactions. Stephanie?
Good morning, Chairman, Commissioners, Deputy Director. My name is Stephanie Simic, and I'm the Wildlife Conflict Section Manager for the Department. And with me today is Mick Cope, our Game Division Manager.
Good morning.
We're here to present the proposed wildlife interaction rules for adoption today. We've been here a couple times before, and you're probably getting sick of seeing my smiling face, but I never stop smiling, even though we deal with conflict in this section. There are three primary reasons why we need to revise these rules. I've addressed some of these prior, but I thought it was a good time to circle back on this. As we discussed during our previous meetings, we fully anticipate that interactions between humans and wildlife in Washington is going to continue to increase over time. We're seeing it nationally and globally. In addition, one of the major changes for us as an agency is in 2013, we transitioned the wildlife conflict responsibilities, or at least most of the wildlife conflict responsibilities, from our enforcement program into our wildlife program. And in doing so, it gave us a chance to begin looking at and reviewing our rules, and we found that there were some modifications that were needed, as well as some additional rules that should be provided, or at least proposed, to provide further direction for the agency and for our public. We began our initial scoping process and reaching out to stakeholders in May of 2014, and during that time, we were able to hear concerns regarding the roles and responsibilities of the affected parties and the roles and responsibilities of the department with respect to addressing wildlife conflict issues. We contracted a third-party entity to conduct two surveys. One was directed at our Washington hunters, and the other was directed at the Washington residents regarding wildlife issues, including wildlife conflict issues. This further assisted us with understanding the public opinions statewide. We wrote our game management plan, and through that process, we were able to take in public comment on wildlife conflict issues, as well as we were able to travel across the state and meet with stakeholders and constituents throughout the state. Additionally, we've worked with our various advisory groups and committees to gain additional comment and input on these rules. Our stakeholder outreach hasn't stopped. We've continued that all the way through up until even May of 2015. We continued reaching out and meeting with folks. We had numerous meetings and email correspondences and telephone conversations with key stakeholders and individual members of the public. I've listed some of the key stakeholders here that we had specific meetings throughout that year with. Additionally, these meetings and correspondences and outreach entities and outreach efforts have led to our filing of a proposed revised rule in May 2015. So it was the compilation of that full year of outreach that led to our filed proposed rule. And even in through May and all the way up to the June commission meeting, we continued our stakeholder outreach. We met again with these stakeholders and or we responded to their letter, the comment letters. And through that process, we were able to gain even further insight into their interests and their concerns. We presented the proposed rules and received further public comment at the June Fish and Wildlife Committee meeting, or commission meeting, excuse me, and public hearing. Based on those public comments and the additional feedback we received from the stakeholders during that process, we then filed a revised proposed rule in July of 2015. And the reason we opted to go with a revised rule is we felt there were some significant changes through that process. This provided an opportunity for expanded public comment again by proposing the revised rules. Our stakeholder outreach on the revised rules continued all the way through September. Again, we were meeting with folks, doing follow-up correspondences, in-person meetings, email, telephone conversations. And during that time, we continued to follow up with those stakeholders who had expressed interest from day one, and we found some other stakeholders that surfaced during that time. So we met with them as well. Additionally, during this time, we filed our SEPA documents. We provided a response to comments on the SEPA filing, and we received a final determination of non-significance. We also presented the rules at the September Commission meeting and public hearing and received additional comments and input during that meeting. Since then, we've continued our outreach efforts with stakeholders all the way through, in fact, this morning. And here again is a list of some of the primary folks that we've been working more closely with. During this process, we've made several recommended adjustments to the proposed rules, as well as some technical edits, which are in your notebooks. And then, in addition, during this presentation, I have a few additional floor changes that have resulted from our meetings with these folks. So to begin, we've again organized our rules under the four categories to simplify this process for all of us. The categories we're using are damage to agriculture and timber, killing wildlife in protection of property, compensation, and wildlife control operators. We'll begin with the damage to agriculture and timber as our first section of rules to review. Just to remind everyone again, we were proposing to delete rules 232.12.025, depredation hunts, and 232.28.266, damage prevention permit hunts. And our objective here is to replace and revise those rules with new rules under the Wildlife Interactions Chapter 232.36. So the first rule under the damage to agriculture and timber rule is WAC 232.36.310. And this, the recommended adjustments and such on this WAC are in pages 9 through 15 in your notebook. This is our damage prevention permit hunt WAC. It replaces the 232.28.266 WAC. In summary, it serves to facilitate landowners in mitigating deer, elk, turkey damage during appropriate time frames. And so some of the changes that we've made, or some of the significant changes we made from the original WAC, is that we aligned the seasons with the chronic damage periods, and we increased quotas in those areas where we see significant chronic damage. Additionally, we identified the use of the damage prevention permits, the cooperative agreements, and the damage tags. The rationale here was primarily to provide efforts to improve our data collection, provide mitigation efforts for landowners, and expedite our response to landowner needs. We do have a floor change on this WAC, WAC 232.36.310, page 12, subsection 3E. The floor change is to insert a new sub-I, and the text would read season framework, July 1 through March 31. The rationale for this is the season framework wasn't identified in the original proposed rule, and it should be included to clearly define when the actions may occur in GMUs 105 through 124. Yes, Commissioner?
Now, GMUs 105, because I know earlier there's some issues brought up about when we could address some elk damage issues. Is that just specific to 105?
This is actually specific to the deer. It's under the deer subsection.
Okay.
Elk is already, it says July for elk.
Okay, but we're good on that one on elk too?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir. It was omitted under the deer section.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. So moving on to the next WAC, 232.36.320. This is a WAC that replaces 232.12.025. And this WAC is our black bear timber damage depredation permits. Excuse me. The recommended adjustments are in your notebook on page 16 through 19. The summary of this WAC is that it basically outlines the requirements for mitigating black bear timber damage up to commercial timber through the director-authorized black bear depredation permit. primary changes. We clarified the process for obtaining and using the black bear removal permit, and we separated it. The original WAC had bear, deer, elk all in one WAC, so we've separated them out as separate WACs. And the rationale is that the standalone rule would further assist us in more effectively addressing bear timber damage to commercial properties. The next WAC is 232-36-300. This is our public hunting requirements WAC. In summary, this is actually the recommended adjustments are on pages 20 and 21 in your notebook. This WAC clearly defines public hunting as a tool to help minimize property damage that's caused by wildlife. The benefits of this WAC and the changes that we made are that it clearly identifies that the affected property is open for the species that's causing the damage. It allows us some flexibility in determining the hunting parameters, such as the who, what, when, where, in collaboration with the landowner. And then it also allows for situations when hunting may not be practical. So it recognizes the value for using hunters as a tool to further deter damage on property, but it also recognizes that not all properties are conducive to hunting and allows the agency to address that on a one-on-one with the landowner. So areas that may be considered as not practical, you know, include situations where a lessee may not have the ability to say on the property he's leasing that he could have hunting on that property. The next WAC is actually a new rule. It's 232-36-090. It's on pages 22 through 24. This is a limitations to managing damage caused by big game on private property. Basically, it outlines the roles and responsibilities of the department and owners to work collectively and collaboratively to minimize the damage caused by big game. And the benefit of this rule is that it actually provides a process by which we work together to resolve the issues of disagreement, and particularly with respect to the damage prevention measures that are chosen for each scenario. So we're moving on to the next section, which is killing wildlife and protection of property. The first one under this section is WAC 232-36-051. This is killing wildlife causing damage on private property. The recommended adjustments are on pages 26 through 32 in your notebooks. And the summary is that this clarifies for landowners when they may kill wildlife causing property damage and clarifies the use of our permits and agreements. One of the nice or larger changes that we've made in this is we actually separated our responses for commercial crop damage and our response to livestock damage. It identifies specific parameters that are associated with the damage removals, and it defines who can take action. There was some concern from our stakeholders that they didn't understand who could take action, if one of their family members could take action or not, so we clarified that. The rationale really is that, you know, there are different tools and different ways that we address both crop damage and livestock damage, and so it was important for us to separate those and make it clear for both parties to understand where their protection of their property falls. The next rule is WAC 232-36-055. This is our disposal of wildlife kill for personal safety or causing private property damage. This just outlines clearly the proper disposal methods for a constituent to take. The language was modified to ensure that the steps taken were within state statute, agency rule, agency permit, and or local ordinances following those categories. The rationale was to reduce potential violations by both permittees and folks who are out assisting landowners with removing wildlife. The next rule is WAC 232-36-330. This is our bear and cougar depredation permit hunts for domestic animal or livestock loss. This is a new rule. It's brought in. It basically outlines the requirements for the use of the director-authorized bear and cougar removal permits in response to livestock and domestic animal loss. This is separate of what we have for the public safety cougar removal, which is WAC 232-12-243. So this is when we have a different situation. We may have a producer that's affected by an individual, a bear or cougar. This addresses their need, not the chronic area issues. WAC 232-36-510 is the next WAC that we have. This is a failure to abide by the conditions of a permit or provided complete forms or submit report requirements. This is on recommended adjustments are in on your pages 41 and 42 in your notebook. Basically, this clearly identifies the violations associated with failure to comply with those conditions. It is mostly technical changes that we made in this WAC, and it currently identifies the correct parties who are responsible for reporting. Next section, compensation. The first rule under compensation is WAC 232-36-100. This clearly outlines the requirements for owners to file for deer and elk damage claims for commercial crops. The changes that we made were clarifying when the damage claims would be denied. We also provide information for the use of the damage prevention agreements, the department-approved checklist, and we've introduced the director's waiver. It also further clarifies that claims would be carried over if funds are depleted during the fiscal year. And these were concerns that were brought forward to us from the stakeholders. The main rationale for this rule is to alleviate the confusion for owners regarding the limitations for crop damage and also provide us some flexibility in addressing the non-lethal measures. Next rule, WAC 232-36-110. This rule is on pages 49 and 55 in your notebook. It's application for cash compensation for commercial crop damage. And this one articulates the filing process for filing for commercial crop compensation. It clearly identifies that it really is a collaborative process with the claimant and the department. And it's reinstating the shared responsibility of the owner and the department to cost share the contracted agricultural adjuster's fees. And I'll go into that in just a second. So the rationale for reinstating this cost share, I know that you've heard from some of our stakeholders on this issue, so we felt it was important for us to kind of walk through this with you. In 2010, a rule was adopted requiring that the fee itself would be cost shared. It would be a shared responsibility between the owner and the department. And that rule was on the books until 2013 when we proposed a revision to the rule to put the responsibility solely on the department. In October of 2013, there was a floor amendment that was adopted that reinstated it to a shared responsibility. Unfortunately, there was a technical error, and the amendment was not inserted into the WAC correctly when it was posted as rule. And so in 2015, we are proposing to reinstate that cost share again with the $600 cap. Another rule under compensation is 232-36-210. This is specific to filing process for claims for livestock loss or domestic animal damage compensation that are caused by bear, cougar, and wolf. The primary changes for us were to provide notification of when the claimant should notify the department. We've extended the dates for submission of the claims package. We've also extended the date or the time frame for the claimant to notify the department. And we further outlined the assessment of losses by wolves versus other carnivores. One of the main reasons we did these actions was to enable a claims process that ensures adequate time for the producer or the owner to submit their application, and then also to provide clear provisions for filing claims. And that would identify, and that would further identify the variations between wolf compensation and other carnivore compensation pieces. Next section is wildlife control operators. This is WAC 232-12-142. We're on pages 64 through 72 in your notebooks. This rule simply outlines the use of the special trapping permit. We've removed the use of body-ripping traps from the rule itself, a modified language that is related to the permit application and use. We've also modified language regarding carcass retention and permit renewal. The rationale is to try to provide further clarification regarding the use of these trapping permits and to help facilitate the potential for minimizing violations. We do have several floor changes for this rule. The first floor change is WAC 232-12-142, page 64 on your notebooks, subsection 1A. We are requesting to strike the terms noose traps used in falconry. This language is redundant to a subsection further in the rule, which is under the title of non-strangling foot snares. Additionally, I just want to read into record that the sentence of this under this subsection 1A would read, cage and box traps, suitcase trap, live beaver traps, and common and rat mouse traps are not considered body gripping traps. The next floor change related to this WAC, WAC 232-12-142, is on page 70. It's subsection 11. We're requesting to insert the words, unless the carcass is accompanied by a written authorization as described in 232-12-077 from a licensed trapper. The rationale for this is that this language will allow a trapper to transfer a raw fur to another party for educational purposes. So under subsection 11, the new subsection would read, any retention of raw fur obtained through the use of a special trapping permit requires a valid Washington State trapper's license unless the carcass is accompanied by a written authorization as described in 232-12-077 from a licensed trapper. The final floor change for this rule, WAC 232-12-142, pages 71 and 72, subsection 15A, we are requesting to reinstate the terms 600 Capitol Way North. The rationale is that we had originally proposed to go to our formal P.O. Box address, but realized that P.O. Box were unable to accept certified mail there, and this new language will allow us to receive appeals from claimants under a certified mail process. So the last sentence of subsection 15A would then read, address appeals to WDFW Legal Services Office, 600 Capitol Way North, P.O. Box 43137, Olympia, Washington, 98504-3137. Moving on to the next rule, WAC 232-36060. This rule defines the criteria for applying for a wildlife control operator certification. We've revised the language to separate certification and from permits. It was mixed in the previous rules. And we've further defined the minimum requirements for certification. The rationale was to clearly clarify the language, to eliminate the confusion, and help ensure wildlife control operators had the skills to assist the public. We do have one floor change for this rule, WAC 232-36060, page 74, subsection 1B. We're requesting to strike the language, applicants may document the two-year experience requirement by, and we are asking to replace that with the language, methods of documenting experience include but are not limited to. The rationale for this is based on working with our stakeholders. This language would allow for multiple methods of verifying experience. As you heard earlier from Mick, there was some concern we might have been keeping it a little too restrictive. So the new language under subsection 1B will read, methods of documenting experience include but are not limited to possessing a trapper's license for 2 years, providing a letter of recommendation from a currently certified WCO or trapper, providing evidence being employed in the wildlife abatement field for 2 years, providing a written statement verifying they are currently working with a certified WCO or other method as identified by the department. We have an additional floor change for this piece on page 75. So it's WAC 232-36060, page 75, subsection 1E. We're requesting to strike as written and replace it with the following language. Subsection 1E, not have within the last 3 years. Sub I, more than one finding of paid or committed as a final disposition for an infraction under Chapter 7715 RCW, or sub II, a conviction for a fish and wildlife crime under Chapter 7715 RCW. The rationale for this was that the language provides a clarification on violations and would prohibit certifications, as well as this new language will include felony convictions, whereas the previous language did not address felony convictions. Next rule, 232-36065. This guides how wildlife control operators will function in the field. We revised the language to clearly separate again the certification from the permit. And we've defined how wildlife control operators may capture, release, or retain wildlife. We've also defined parameters for revocation of permits or certifications. Again, this is just to provide consistency and clarity and expectations of the role of the wildlife control operator, as well as consistency with our other rules. We have a floor change for this. It's WAC 232-36065, page 78, subsection 3. We would like to add the language, except for beaver released according to RCW 7732-585. The rationale here was to allow respond to stakeholders asking for clarification that beavers could be released as provided by law. So subsection 3 would then read, WCOs who trap wildlife under the authority of a department permit may not release wildlife outside of the property boundary where they are captured without a permit from the department, except for beaver released according to 7732-585, or dispose of such wildlife without the consent of the property owner where wildlife is to be disposed. We have an additional floor change for WAC 232-36065, page 81. Subsection 9A, again, requesting to reinstate the physical address of 600 Capitol Way North. The rationale, again, is for allowing receipt of certified mail from applicants that request an appeal. The last sentence of subsection 9A would then read, address appeals to WDFW Legal Services Office, 600 Capitol Way North, P.O. Box 43137, Olympia, Washington, 98504-3137. The next rule is actually a new rule. It's a report requirements of a certified wildlife control operators, 232-36066. Literally, it just outlines the reporting requirements for those folks that are certified as control operators. It provides guidance to them on how to report and when to report. This is on pages 83 and 84 in your notebook. Next rule, WAC 232-36054, use of body gripping traps. This is on pages 85 and 86 in your notebook. Defines the use of these body gripping traps. It includes language that we had extracted from 232-36141 in a previous commission meeting. And the intent here is to provide guidance again to wildlife control operators that utilize body gripping traps, as well as to other trappers that may be utilizing these traps. We have a floor change for this. The floor change for WAC 232-36054, page 85, subsection 2A. We're proposing to strike the language social and, so that the subsection 2A should then read 2A, to protect public health and safety in consultation with the Department of Health Services or the United States Department of Health and Human Services. And the rationale, quite frankly, is to reference the correct agency. So our next steps, we are here, obviously, we've been through a fairly strenuous process, I think, with our stakeholders and trying to engage and ensure that we're meeting some of their concerns. There are several places within the proposals that were technical edits. They were made. We've updated some terms. We've adjusted some language, primarily to provide consistency, further clarification, proper grammar for that matter, and answer questions as expressed by the public and our stakeholders. And those are all in your notebooks. It's important for us to leave here today with these rules adopted so that we can move forward with our policy revisions. That's really our next step, is to begin revising our existing policies and looking at where we may need to develop new policies. We're facing, of course, a critical time coming in spring when much of the conflict issues start to burgeon up and explode again for us. Spring is a really late winter, actually, and early spring is a time when we need to be ready and we need to have our policies and rules in place and be prepared. So we plan to work on the policies and continue our collaboration with our external stakeholders as much, if not more, than we have in the past, as well as working with our internal staff and staff from all the various programs across our agency, as well as staff from other agency programs. And with that, I'll take any questions, or Mick, if you had anything else you'd like to add.
No.
Thank you. That's very detailed and very informative.
That's my only picture. Sorry.
That's a good one. Questions from the commission? Mr. Keeney.
Thank you. I think I just have one question. It's mostly to clarify in my own mind, and I believe, I'm not sure if I'm in the right place, but it'd be WAC 232.12.142. Section 10 on page 70. It's about the raw fur changes. Mm-hmm. So I just want to make sure I understand if I got it right. So under RCW, prior to this, the department has the authority to issue a permit to take out a problem animal with using a licensed trapper, using leg hold traps. And prior to this, they could dispose of that fur in a number of ways. They could keep it, they could send it to a commercial tanner and have it tanned, and later sell it commercially if they so chose, prior to this. So is what this is doing is trying to fill or stop a potential loophole in that process where it could, for instance, get out of hand where people are giving permits to trap a beaver that's causing a problem, and those furs are then going to a commercial tanner, being tanned, and then back to the trapper, and then sold in a commercial way, which I think what we're trying to say is that's not how it was interpreted, or how we would interpret it, that law was written. So I guess I want to make sure I'm on track, and then also, has there been any problem that says we need to interpret that RCW with a WAC change? Because if not, I would kind of wonder. But I just wanted to open that up for you to comment.
I'll have staff answer your second question. Okay. The first question is you are interpreting that correctly in the intent of, in the view of the work that we've done within the department and working with the AG's office, is the intent of the initiative was to not commercialize animals caught in body gripping traps. This is a special permit that's put in, a special authority that's given the agency to use body gripping traps in these situations, and we were just trying to clarify that we wanted not to have commercial enterprise associated with that. But I'll have Stephanie address the second question.
Yes, and so to address your second question, this concern actually came up from various stakeholders, both internally and externally. The question came regarding this. And so we felt it was because of the confusion, literally the confusion, we went back and addressed the RCW and then assess that we should probably put language in the WAC that helps direct folks to understand this process. And in doing so, we worked with the Trappers Association on this issue, and they were the ones who illustrated to us, hey, there are times when we actually use these for educational purposes, and we really need to have that clarified in there. And so we went back and readjusted the language to allow for those entities to provide educational opportunities.
And just to add on to that, Commissioner, I think there was confusion amongst staff and how it was being interpreted across the state, and so it was a little different in different parts of the state, and folks were getting different answers. So this was an attempt to clarify that, so there was a consistent approach across the state.
Okay, I appreciate that. And I was curious, you know, once you've determined you have a wildlife problem, and you've determined to take the action to issue a permit, and that includes a body gripping trap, or maybe they want to catch it with the trapper would use a non-body gripping trap, but however they catch it, the animal will be killed. And then the use of that fur, to me, was, I guess it was a little unclear to me why we were at that point saying, the animal's dead. It died one way or the other. And it's going to be used in-house or for education or for commercial. To me, it doesn't have a big difference. You know, there's so little of this that goes on. But I was thinking there must have been instances of problems to initiate this. So that's why I was asking.
Yeah, and I think that was borne out in kind of the inconsistent approach that was used in different parts of the state. We were getting different, or the public was getting different answers from the agency.
That's correct. And in addition, I'd like to add, Commissioner, that this is specific to the body gripping traps itself. The special permit is specific to that. If it was a live trap, there wouldn't be this issue.
This is specific. It could go for commercial use if it wasn't a body gripping trap.
That's correct.
I guess that the scope of it, again, kind of escapes me, how much of this happens. And, it, you know, I was originally picturing this as, well, it's all kinds of furs, but I think it's primarily beavers. But, okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Commissioner Carpenter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nick, Stephanie, thank you very much. It's a very complex bunch of issues here, so I've been contacted by a couple stakeholders, and for my own naivety, I have two hypotheticals for you. So you have the Smith family that lives in North Central Washington. Mm-hmm. Rancher, farmer, husband's out in the field, wife's a school teacher, three kids are home. One,
I know them.
I think we all
sound,
do.
Sound familiar? One male, about 14, 15, and two of his sisters. They have domestic animals and pets in their yard. Hypothetical situation A is more than one. Well, first of all, I am on, just so I can.
You're in 051.
051. You know that one, okay. And I'm on page 29. So, hypothetical A either has more than one bear or more than one cougar, all of which will sometimes prey as a pack, I'll call it a pack, or as a group. So either the bear or the cougars are attacking their domestic animals. The 16-year-old male grabs a family gun and goes out, and he shoots one. The rest of them are still continuing on with the depredation. He shoots another one. He might even shoot a third one if he had three in his. Okay, hypothetical B is now you got a pack of wolves. Same scenario. And over here on D, as it applies on page 29, it talks about bear and cougar. Give me the outcome of that set of dynamics.
Sure. So the base answer behind scenario one and probably scenario two is you have a constitutional right to protect your property. It falls within what is reasonable and necessary to accomplish to relieve the situation. If there's two or three cougars attacking the family livestock, they need and they take appropriate action. That's well within the constitutional right. And the rule itself doesn't rewrite the constitutional, or you redirect that constitutional right. So we're putting this in there as guidance under a, kind of balancing the scale a little bit to show that there isn't just in any situation a wide open door, but there is always the constitutional right to protect your property within what's reasonable and necessary. And that may answer your second question as well.
Yeah, okay. So each situation will be reviewed on its merit? Is that?
Yes, and there's been times when that's been looked at and over history. There may be, it'll just be an evaluation of the situation and whether that becomes a reasonable and necessary and action.
Okay, thank you. I think.
Okay.
Boy, I was not really looking forward to this item after the conversation that we had this morning. Then I'm going to share a little bit of the flavor of our Wildlife Committee conversation about this. And also reflect on some of the other very tough, contentious, heartfelt, passionately difficult topics that the Commission is often required to make a decision on. First of all, I asked the question this morning in our Wildlife Committee meeting, what would be the harm in just spending one more month looking at these remaining sources of heartburn in this rule package? Can we just, as a commission, give ourselves one more month to mull over some of these tougher ones, and in so doing, give the public an opportunity to, and our constituents, one more time to look at the complete package with all floor changes, with all late-breaking changes that some have pointed out to us in the emails that we've gotten and the phone calls we've gotten? They just haven't really seen the complete end product that we're looking at today. Not that they didn't have an opportunity if they dug deep enough to find out, but we would accomplish the end of giving everybody one last chance at this final package that we've arrived at. We'd give the commission a chance to mull over some of these tougher questions, and I listed a few, and I'm not sure where what I feel about this, the fee, for example, the fee that we impose that we're being asked to clarify would be reimposed. We thought we imposed it several years ago. It was erroneously not included in the rules. So we're being asked to correct that and reaffirm that choice that was made a few years ago. And I'm sympathetic, too, to the view of the landowners who say, we ask of them, they provide a service to us, which is their open space that supports our wildlife and many times our hunting activities. So we're sympathetic to the landowners who don't want to see that bite taken out of their pocketbook when they have a damage claim. So I pose the question, can we just delay this vote or pieces of this vote until next month? And I've seen it in the past in dealing with controversial, big, complex subjects that leave a few topics still sore spots for various constituents who have worked very hard. And my view is that if we do delay for a month, when we have made that choice of delaying for a month, it has led to people seeing us as being responsive, seeing the decision makers. Now, there's no question staff have been responsive. Months and months and months of back and forth, over a year now. I mean, you did a great description, a great portrait of the effort that you guys have made to modify, to revise, to massage, to shape. So there is no question about your responsiveness. The responsiveness burden is on us now, on the commission as the ones making the final decision. So I laid that out, and we had a lively conversation. I'd say the Wildlife Committee was evenly split in the wisdom of this. Staff would love to get beyond this phase, as Stephanie mentioned so well. They've got more work to be done, and they'd like to get moving on that. And another question I had is, well, could you not start developing those policies, those procedures for applying these rules, call them drafts? Because one more point that I've received from constituents that causes some heartburn is this idea among particularly those constituents who don't trust the agency very much. They would like to have a better sense of what is going to be in these policies because they suspect that we're going to slip some substantive things in there, some things that aren't just pro forma boilerplate tools for implementing our policy choices, but that actually the policies or procedures that are referred to that you're talking about developing next might have some substantive choices in them. So if we gave them a view of what's in these draft policies, that should put that concern to rest. But it would take some weeks to do that. So I wanted to make that comment so you understood we had this good debate during the Wildlife Committee meeting. And if staff do not want us to put off this decision, but I think it could be beneficial if we did.
So I'd like to just reflect a little bit of the other side of the debate that we had. I feel that as I've seen this evolve, that staff, as we acknowledged, has been extremely they've listened and responsive to stakeholder input. I was not clear on what an additional month was going to do because I don't see that it would necessarily satisfy, and we've heard from the stakeholders, they're not entirely satisfied with all of the rules as they've been developed, and there's still some concerns. Is another month going to change that? And we heard from staff the importance of getting these rules passed so that they can proceed with the next steps and prepare for the season spring when a lot of the conflicts occur. We also were reassured by staff that there would be extensive stakeholder input into the development of policies and procedures, maybe even more than the rules because it doesn't have the formal process to it that rulemaking does. So it might be easier to get stakeholder input, and we receive those assurances. I trust staff. The final point was made that, these are a bunch of new and complicated rules. They're probably not perfect. We have the ability to update rules. Staff said there's probably going to be the need to make changes to these rules in the not-too-distant future. So I see no reason to postpone a decision on this. I think that staff is done their due diligence, we've done our due diligence, and that there is a need to proceed with the rulemaking today.
Thank you. I just want to, Kim said it very well in my standpoint, and I just wanted to be clear that we did have a good debate on this, which is what should happen in committees. and which should happen on a commission. And so this was definitely not a recommendation coming from the Wildlife Committee to postpone. It's a suggestion. I tend to agree with Commissioner Thornburg on this, that we've had enough time, and we're not going to satisfy everybody in every case. But I also think that it's not a place in the rules we make to specifically lay out every item that would encumber government, that would encumber this agency way too much. And it would be very hard to change if there were some minor changes that needed to be made that I think should occur outside of that rule, which occurs later. And we had, good assurances from staff that people that are not satisfied with a particular item are more than welcome and will be invited to that table to create the exact rules, regulations, policy that go with the rules or the policy that or policies. Policy that goes with what we're deciding today. So I agree, too. I think it's time to move on, get the decision done. There's plenty of space left around to make things to take into account landowners' concerns. Your turn.
Oh.
Miranda had some viable points, but I guess I'm going to fall to the fact that a wise man once said, never let the perfect become the enemy of the good. And as far as a landowner rancher, this is way beyond good. I'm really pleased the steps that you guys are taking. There's been a lot of due diligence. Mick and I had a phone conversation first a week. He addressed some of my concerns and issues. And as you have stated earlier, yeah, there's going to be some hiccups. There was a lot of thought went into this, but then we hit the real world and things haven't changed. There again, as long as it's on paper, not chiseled in stone, and we can address the issues as they come up, I feel that I can go back to the farm and ranching community and say, yeah, we're going in the right direction, and if we come up with some problems, we can address them. I feel very confident in going ahead and voting, and no, command staff for where we were at. The whole procedure going from enforcement to wildlife to me is huge. And there's been a lot of very good things addressed in this, so that's thank you.
Thank you.
What was that first quote?
Don't let the perfect get in the way of the good.
Never let the perfect become the enemy of the good.
Oh, there we go.
There's sage down there.
That's surprising.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to step out of my role here, but I do want to back up the staff recommendation about moving forward. Very complex rule. You've seen the extensive two or three times the normal effort we put into the public involvement piece of this. It's a living document. We are learning. It's getting more and more important and more out in front for the agency as time goes by. I'm just worried about implementation and being able to be responsive on that end of it too, and the ability to adjust landowner damage contracts in a timely way before calving and lambing starts to deal with Mr. Miller's spring bear depredations and to do it right in terms of the policy updates. Concerned about the clock ticking and we will come back and we will look at additional changes and making this thing better as time goes by. So just ask you to think about that, and I know you will.
Further discussion? I think we're ready for, we have a motion.
I move to adopt the repeal of WACs 232-12-025 and 232-28-266. Adopt the new WAC sections listed in Appendix A and amend the WAC sections listed in Appendix B as presented.
Do we have a second to the motion?
Second.
Commissioner Thornburg, seconding it. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Thank you, guys.